Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, we start with the good news. And our good martini is Mark Halperin slightly redeeming himself after that ridiculous interview with Ted Cruz, having a focus group discussion with Iowa Democrats. And he asked the question that a lot of conservatives have been asking about Hillary Clinton lately. What exactly has she accomplished? And in this question, particularly as Secretary of State, he got two different answers, this one from a bunch of people.
What did she accomplish that you consider significant as Secretary of State?
Secretary of State? I really can't name anything off the top of my head.
Give me a minute. Give me 2 minutes to go someplace else.
Okay, Christina, can you think of something that she accomplished as Secretary of State that impressed you or thinks important? Amanda, anything you do to say this is a good credential for...
I honestly can't say I followed along everything that was going on that well.
Well, those are ringing endorsements. They're going to vote for her anyway. And this guy seemed to be the only one willing to try and explain why he's voting for Hillary, even though he can't really name any accomplishments. And this is a gem, too.
She's been at a high level in numerous offices for about 25 years now. I mean, it's either going to be that or it's going to be Scott Walker, you know, but taking away, you know, destroying America's unions. And there's just, you know, she's not perfect. But she's been in the eye for a long time, in the public's eye, and you're going to have some stuff on her. But, you know, she has great policies, and she knows how to get stuff done.
So, Jim, the good news here is that obviously people are not that enthused about Hillary and can't really name any accomplishments. On the other hand, they don't really seem to care.
There are a couple fascinating kind of tidbits in those answers there. First is that last guy at the end, one of the younger guys, absolutely certain that she knows how to get stuff done. Except he can't think of anything that she's actually gotten done. And I'm sure if you asked that crowd, how do you think Hillary did the job as Secretary of State? They'd probably praise her to the high heavens. She did a great job. And then you say, well, what did she do? And all of a sudden, the awkward silence. Everybody starts looking at each other. Not, I need more time. I haven't followed this so closely and things like that. Now, you might look at that and say, oh, okay, Hillary's support is a mile wide and an inch deep. But what's fascinating is that as much as there's the awkward silence and they don't look thrilled that they've been put on the spot and can't think of anything, it's not like anybody in that room says, I'm not sure I'm going to vote for her. Right? I mean, like the fact that they can't mention any accomplishment, they can't point to any success stories, the fact that they know she's been in, was Secretary of State for 4 years and can't point to, aha, the invasion of Libya has worked wonders for us. You know, the efforts in the Middle East, reaching out to the Syrian resistance against Assad, all of that is doing fantastic. Thank goodness we got our troops out of Iraq. Things are a lot better there now. They can't say any of that stuff because there's pretty much been a disaster just about everywhere. They don't even go for the desperate reaching, our relationship with Burma has never been stronger, claim that sometimes you'll get from the really knowledgeable, really desperate Hillary fans. And so the first of all is that ultimately this doesn't really matter to them. The Democratic Party, first, you know, you could make this argument about how they nominated Obama back in 2008. They don't look for a record of accomplishment. They don't really care about that part. They want to feel good. And I'm sure a lot of these folks in this focus group and a lot of Hillary supporters are going to feel good about themselves because she'd be the first woman president. And my sense is this all kind of has gathered around the sense that she was a victim. She was a victim of Bill not treating her well. She was a victim of her critics. And she tried with Hillary Care back in 1994, and it didn't go well for her. And this kind of sense of, she really deserves the presidency as a consolation prize for how she suffered. They were dead broke when they left the White House. They're trying to get by on $100 million a year. They have to make all these friends in the Russian government and all this. Like, you find yourself twisting yourselves in knots. And so on the one hand, this is a fantastic example of how her fans can't say anything she did. Obviously, the more undecided Americans are going to be even tougher to persuade them that she's a great leader based upon her time in the State Department. On the other hand, kind of the downside to this is that they don't really seem to care. Their criteria for a candidate is entirely emotional and not based on rational and facts and things like that.
Well, that makes the job of trying to convince some of them to change course a little bit harder. Facts and rational arguments aren't going to have much difference. Let's hope at least some people who normally vote for Democrats are open to rational discussion and debate over the next year or so, because otherwise it could be a very frustrating venture. All right, on to the bad martini now, and this is a triple-headed monster, which kind of goes back to Hillary's time as Secretary of State. ISIS once again on the march. And first of all, we find out that the Pentagon is admitting now that Iraqi troops, surprise, surprise, did not want to fight ISIS for Ramadi. Nancy Youssef writing in the Daily Beast, in the face of a vicious ISIS assault, the Iraqi army ran away, leaving the American plan to beat the terror group in tatters. They saw the ISIS attack coming and they ran. The American strategy to fight ISIS in Iraq depends on local troops standing up to the terror army. The Iraqi forces chose not to fight, much as they did last year when ISIS sacked the city of Mosul. There's another story out there saying that ISIS is strengthening its foothold in Libya and putting itself in a better position to wreak more havoc based out of there. And if that weren't enough, reports are now suggesting that ISIS fighters seized around a third of the historic Syrian city of Palmyra on Wednesday after fierce clashes with the military. The city is also known as Tadmor in Arabic. A lot of historic sites there. So, Jim, you got Josh Earnest yesterday saying, hey, just because Ramadi fell doesn't mean our strategy's not working. Yeah, it kind of does.
Well, there's Ramadi, there's Libya, and there's Syria. So there's three different fronts. And you know, you and I have talked about this a little bit earlier in the week, but you know, it feels like we just can't say this loud enough. And maybe we have to say this even more bluntly and clearly. Right now, we are losing the war against ISIS, period. Yes, we caught that guy in that raid that we did in Syria, but overall, ISIS is on the march. It is on the march in Libya, which, as we mentioned in that previous martini, is, you know, allegedly one of the crowning achievements of the Hillary Clinton time as Secretary of State. They are advancing in ground in Syria, and they are advancing in ground in Iraq. And ultimately, it looks like the Iraqi army cannot fight at the level we need them to be able to fight in order to, you know, defeat ISIS. So what are we going to do? There's obvious reasons this administration doesn't want to send more combat troops or ground troops into these places. On the flip side, the alternative is to concede it. Nora Rothman, who I think jumped from hot air to contentions over at commentary, was saying, look, are we now in the Vietnam stage of Iraq, and that the American people are like, look, we're done with it. We're tired of it. We don't care if it falls. We don't care if the bad guys take over. We don't care if we see a, you know, U.S. helicopter flying off our embassy roof and leaving the people to be ruled by the enemy. And if that's the case, we are really in a bad spot, because our opponents in Vietnam were willing to stop to a certain extent. ISIS is not going to stop. ISIS is just going to keep killing people until they get, you know, until they've conquered every spot that they want to conquer, which is, I guess, ultimately the world. You don't see any talk of intensity from this from the administration. You are starting to see the anonymous sources in the Defense Department and other places start to say, whoa, this is really looking bad. Losing Ramadi is a big deal. Things are not going better in Libya. Things are not going better in Syria. But this administration just wants to keep whistling past the graveyard. And I kind of want to see you're seeing more criticism of the Obama administration up on the Hill. Maybe it's time for the Republican presidential candidates to get into this. Jindal has a piece on NRO today. Look, we are losing the war on ISIS, and a lot of people in Washington just seem to be shrugging at that.
Yeah, they don't care. All right, on to the crazy martini now, Jim, and this one is kind of maddening at the same time. New poll done by YouPromise, which is an outshoot of Sallie Mae, and the Forbes version of this story reads that approximately 65% of parents expect to support their kids for up to 5 years after they graduate from college. And the percentage of parents who think their kids will be leaning on them for more than 2 years doubled to 36% from 18% in 2014. So in just a year, their college-bound kids concur. Some 68% of them expect financial support from mom and dad after leaving school. Part of that reality is that only 25% of parents expect their child to have a job in their chosen field by the time they graduate. And 1 out of 10 students expect to wait at least 2 years to find employment in their chosen field after graduation. So the job market completely stinks for these kids, especially in their chosen field. Yet for some reason, they're really happy with the people currently in charge.
Yeah, I hope that the little Columbuses and the little Garrities don't get any ideas from this poll. Look, every parent wants to help out their kids get the best start in life. If that means a bit of time that they're living at home before they move out on their own after college, that's understandable and more understandable in this difficult economy. On the other hand, what you're seeing here, there's a couple of argument in a couple of publications over the weekend arguing, Are we now in a circumstance where the nature of the economy has changed? The era of 4%, 5%, 6% growth is never really going to come back. 2 to 3% growth is what it's going to be. The era of wage growth is over. The era of long-term employment and economic stability is over. That what we've been seeing basically since the 2008 crash is not just the new normal, but we should expect this to go on for decades. Well, if you're just starting out in your working life now, or if you've started back in 2008, 2009 and on, you're now pretty much guaranteed to have lower wages for the rest of your life. The longer it takes you to get into the workforce and the longer it takes you to get that full-time job, it means it's the longer it's going to take you to get the job that's got the good benefits and things like that. Everything gets pushed back. Everything gets delayed. Everything gets smaller. And obviously, if you know about the fascinating rules about compound interest, the longer it takes you to start that 401k or start saving for retirement, the less you're going to have. So you're having this entering working generation of millennials who suddenly are kind of facing diminished expectations. I can't say I think this is a particularly healthy development in American life. If it becomes you don't really move out of the house until you're 23, 24, 25, and obviously we know cases of some folks who have to stick around until their 30s. That's really what a lot of Europe has turned into. And it's a kind of ossified lack of ability to grow up and be your own adult. I was going to say be your own man, but perhaps hinting at a book that I'm writing. but the idea of being something in which you stand on your own two feet, you're gainfully employed, you're ready to get married someday, you're ready to have kids, you're ready to do what your parents did. And it feels like that's kind of sliding away for a lot of young people. And this is a major crisis. And it'd be really great to see people who want to lead us speak honestly about this. But instead, we're going to talk about, Greg, LA raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour. So that's going to fix everything, right?
Exactly right. Man, you got some kids now. They're starting college. They're graduating high school this year. It's been 7 years since they've seen anything close to a healthy economy. So, but ever since they've been paying any attention to the news, this is the normal. And the fact that people are just accepting this and expecting it now might be even more damaging that we haven't actually busted out of this funk yet. Because
The sneaking suspicion that people don't know that it can be better and it should be better.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we have to continue to promote. And let's hope some of the candidates do that, because that should be a message that resonates very well with young people and their parents, who would probably like to have a little bit of their own money for their own retirement purposes rather than just supporting their kids in perpetuity. So, Jim, on that exciting and encouraging note, we'll call time for today. See you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.